listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice, a nonprofit media organization. This is a series of presidential campaign period programs, this topic being the social impact of the U.S. military budget. Robert Scheer spoke in San Diego, California on July 26, 2008, about his latest book, The Pornography of Power: How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America.
Let me throw in one last one. I have loved Barbara Boxer since she was a supervisor in Marin County. So I'm at this dinner party. And Barbara Boxer says, well, this new book you have, what's, you know, I mentioned, she said, oh, that's good. She says, you deal with McCain in there. I say, yeah, but unfortunately, Senator, he comes out looking a little better than you do in my book. And I said, maybe if you answer your emails, and, you know, I wasn't being snotty, but, you know, I mean, I'm you know. And she said, really, why? And I said, well, that C-17 cargo plane you think we have to have. I have a whole chapter on it. And she said, oh, it's a great plane. I said, why? What's it great for? She said, oh, are you kidding? It's so advanced, and it can do this and do that. And she said, have you ever flown in it? What is it supposed to do? Well, we have to support the troops in Iraq. I say, first of all, it's supposed to be a war you don't want to continue, but now you're going to justify a plane that won't even be ready, hopefully, when the war is over. But let's deal with this plane. Right now, over 90% of what goes into Iraq goes by ship. It's a very small fraction of what goes by air, okay? However, if you want to send it by plane to get it there faster, you have UPS and FedEx, which is how we do send a lot of stuff from the military, okay? Plus, we do have a big cargo fleet. We have a big cargo fleet. It's not like we desperately need a new one. What's more, I pointed out to a senator, this is a plane that no one in the Pentagon wants. Okay? They have tried to kill this plane for a decade now. Money has been allocated to mothball the assembly line 5 different times. The only reason this plane is alive is because it's made in Long Beach. And you and Senator Feinstein are backing it because there's something called a Red Alert Team. Red Alert Team. There's this big sign down here in the plant. And what happens? The second it looks like money is going to be cut for this plane that no one wants, you know, except the union and the workers and Boeing, whatever, you know, what happens? You fly, senators, fly back from Washington. Great urgency. Our governor, Schwarzenegger, runs right down. Schwarzenegger gave a couple of speeches there. I tell you, the guy's like a communist or some kind of wild socialist. We will not let them take the jobs from honest workers here. You know, it's like one of those thundering speeches, you know. The workers will not suffer, you know. I never heard him talk like that about the nurses or the teachers. But those workers down there, man, they're, you know, we're going to protect every job. I'm on the case. You get Rohrabacher from Orange County, probably the most right-wing. He loves that plane. He has never wanted to spend a dollar on anything that would help a human being in this country. But anyway, you got the right-wing councilman in Orange County. You got the left-wing councilman on the L.A. side of things. They all back it. Back it, back it, back it. No one can defend it. All right? That's the problem. The problem is the Democrats don't believe the money will ever go to peaceful purposes. They hold on to this. They hold on to the votes. And the Republicans are happy to do it because it's part of the strong America and the profits and so forth. Okay. But there's another consideration. You don't build weapons, and this is what concerned Eisenhower. You don't build weapons without finding an excuse to use them. That's the problem. You know, most of the people who work in this area, whether they're uniform, whether they're doing it for the wage, you know, or profit or something, they want to feel they're doing God's work. They want to feel they're saving the country. Nobody wants to feel corrupt. And they buy into the threat inflation. They buy into the military dimension. They buy into scorn for diplomacy. You know, they buy into the strong unilateral Pax Americana unipower vision. And they find reasons to have the weapons. Remember, why didn't we go into Afghanistan in the first place? Why did we go make the big push for Iraq? I mean, we went into Afghanistan, but not happily and not in, you know, full-throated way. Why? Because, as Rumsfeld said, there were no good targets there. What did he mean? There were no good occasion for shock and awe. There was no good occasion for revving up your Air Force and Navy, blah, 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 because the Taliban didn't have any. You couldn't justify it. What are you going to use it for? They're in caves. You know, how are you going to go get them? And what you had when you built up Saddam Hussein against all rational consideration into another Hitler, a defanged dictator, You know, compare him to the strongest military power in the world at the time, with the best educated population, the highest technology, and so forth. It was disgusting comparison, ridiculous on the face. Nonetheless, you had the appearance of an army, appearance of war. And then it collapsed all too suddenly. You had no reason for being there, but you had your shock and awe. You showed all these toys working. So there's what's built into it, what Eisenhower was warning against, was you don't build these things without developing a constituency for war, for militarism, for being tough, Pax Americana, and so forth. Reason, pacemaking does not seem as profitable. And you develop this enormous constituency in every congressional district all over the country. That's the real danger. Now, I'm going to read one last thing and shut up. Or no, I can't shut up. I have to answer questions. But I just want to read one other thing. I dedicate my book, by the way, to Eisenhower and to George McGovern. And I say to two war heroes who preferred plowshares to swords. And I bring up McGovern. I've told you why I bring up Eisenhower. Did a lot of good things. The one thing is he would not send troops to Vietnam or invade Cuba. You can argue about else he might have done. And he also brought Khrushchev to the United States to demystify the enemy and also to impress the hell out of the guy with, look how we grow wheat and corn, which was the beginning of the unraveling of the Soviet Union. But I put McGovern in there because I want to remind Democrats of what a great man he was. I mean, I think McGovern is one of the great Americans of all time. And the more I've read about him, the more I know about him, you know, I'm just blown away. But the mark against McGovern is, you know, he lost. So he lost to the guy who kicks everybody in the balls, Richard Nixon. But okay. So I remember sitting there one day with McGovern on a nation cruise about 3 years ago. And we're just having iced tea in the back of the boat. And I said, you know, I knew Nixon. I interviewed him, Brown, so forth. And we talked about Nixon. I said, you know, what I could never understand is when Nixon challenged your patriotism, your heroism, your toughness. You know, they painted McGovern, this guy wouldn't defend the country, and blah, 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 you know. I said, here was Nixon, who was a parade guard in the Navy in World War II, right? Never saw any combat. I said, you were one of the genuine heroes of World War II. You were given the Distinguished Flying Cross. You know, 34 missions over Germany, that was suicide missions. You know, half the plane sometimes didn't come back. You crash-landed your plane to save your crew. You know, you're a remarkable hero. And I said, you never brought that up. And he looked at me. I said, why didn't you? And he looked at me and said, it would have been unseemly. Now, I raised that because what he's really saying is not just, you know, I would not look right. He's saying it's the wrong argument to bring up. Anybody can bring up that argument. It doesn't make you right. Just because you're for that war doesn't mean you're right about this war. And that's not how democracy works. That's not how we make decisions. We don't just trust the warriors and so forth. That's what he was talking about when we talked about it. So another person I could have dedicated the book to, who I'm a great admirer of, is another general turned president, George Washington. How many of you have read George Washington's farewell address? Shame on you. You have. Okay. It's going to be on the test, so I want you to pay attention. It's really amazing. It's amazing to me. Everybody talks about our founders, our republic, our background, and so forth. These guys were so, and unfortunately they were guys, I'm sorry, let me apologize, and they were white guys, and there were all sorts of terrible things about them, but they also were geniuses. They were. And one thing they understood very clearly, at least most of them, Gore Vidal always corrects me, because he, of course, he knows more than anybody in the whole world or everybody in the world combined about all, and he actually does. I mean, Gore Vidal's the smartest guy ever lived. So, you know, he knows, so I hate to be corrected by him. But I learn. But anyway, so I will say most of the founders, not all, you know, because he doesn't like Hamilton. Anyway, the clear demarcation between the old world and the new world in the eyes of our founders was between empire and republic. No question about that. The old world was given to foreign mischief, foreign intrigue, what Jefferson referred to, foreign entanglements, foreign engagements, unnecessary. And when you get into those engagements, you can forget about popular control of a republic. This was the lesson of Rome, which they understood very well. It was the lesson of Europe, and they were very conscious of it. That's why you have all the limits on the federal power. That's why you want to keep things local. And I can tell you, as a journalist, I wrote many local columns for the LA Times, and my readers could hold me accountable to the point of extreme discomfort. If I said San Juan, and this happened on two occasions, I referred to San Juan Street instead of San Juan Avenue, 500 letters. Who made you a columnist? What do you know, you know? If you said there should be a red light there, or the sidewalk should be extended, or the police are corrupt, anything, they could find out in real time. The meetings of the city council have to be open. We have sunshine laws. You can't hide behind national security classification. When you talk about the matters of empire, truth never comes out, except by accident. Never. Gulf of Tonkin. I was there at the Los Angeles Times. I finally got a whole 20 years after. I was in Vietnam around the time of the Gulf of Tonkin. I believed it. Must have been attacked. Something must have happened. 20 years later, I'm sitting at the LA Times. I go downstairs to our publisher, Tom Johnson, who, like Bill Moyers, had been in the Johnson White House. Been in White House. I said, Tom, did you know this? He said, what? I said, look, I got these files now. They're just starting to be released 20 years later. And that Lyndon Johnson and Robert McNamara knew in real time that there was no evidence that our ships had been attacked. None. And they went to the nation on television and said, we were attacked. Even though the captain of the Herrick was telling them, no, there's no evidence. We think our radar picked up the zigzags incorrectly. And yet they used that as the excuse for attacking and expanding the war. That was their war declaration. Another story I worked on is the overthrow of Mossadegh in Iran. I called up Kermit Roosevelt in 1979. He told me the whole story, how CIA went in there with, you know, all the money and everything and bought a riot and kicked this guy out. Why? Because he threatened to nationalize some oil companies. You know, so I can go through 100 of these examples. I'm going to end with one than this. But my point is, you can't have both. If you can forget about truth and an informed public, if you have the enemies at the gate, if you're involved in all these foreign machinations, because it's all classified. It's all, you know, we didn't know. When Ngo Dinh Diem, the Democrat we picked for Vietnam, we didn't know our ambassador was in on his assassination when he was scurrying around the sewers of Saigon, except that Daniel Ellsberg risked 80 years in jail to leak the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and the Washington Post. So in the main, if it comes out, it only comes out because of some heroic individuals or by accident. So George Washington was very clear about this. So what did he say? He said, as president, he tried to follow to, quote, our true policy to steer clear of permanent alliances with any portion of the foreign world, taking care always to keep ourselves by suitable establishments on a respectably defensive posture. Now, he was no isolationist any more than Eisenhower or McGovern, where they cared about the rest of the world and so forth. He said, harmony, quote, harmony, liberal intercourse with all nations are recommended by policy, humanity, and interests. But even our commercial policy, and consider this, as we're making these deals now with Iraq for oil companies, taking back their sovereign control of their oil, reversing the worldwide trend, okay? But even our commercial policy should hold an equal and impartial hand, neither seeking nor granting exclusive favors or preferences, consulting the natural course of things, diffusing and diversifying by gentle means, our general. Gentle means the streams of commerce, but forcing nothing. And then he says, this is something I don't know why more people have not. Every time I read this or think about it, I go and Google it again to make sure I didn't make this up. Because it's so brilliant. It's so incredible. Why didn't I ever learn this as a kid in school? And so, you know, now I have lots of copies of his farewell address, and I'm becoming an expert on his farewell address and all the forms of it. Quote, in offering you, my countrymen, these counsels of an old and affectionate friend, to moderate the fury of party spirit, to warn against the mischiefs of foreign intrigue, to guard against the impostures of pretended patriotism. What about if Barack Obama dared to warn us about the impostures of pretended patriotism? They'd hang him. And that was George Washington. So let me end by a more current note, and not to be excessively controversial, but I do want to discuss the presidential campaign for just a minute. I wrote a column this week, if you go to Truth Dig or any other way, The Nation, Alternate, whatever, you can read it, and it's out there. And I make the point that Barack Obama is in danger of becoming a hack. And I've said all those flattering things before, right? And I say that not because of a failing on his part, but because of a failing on the part of the political process. My last book was called Playing President. And it's all about the destructive political exercise that we go through, the role of money, the opportunism, the mass media, and so forth, and that all of the presidents that I dealt with basically didn't know which end was up by the time they got to be president. And I interviewed all of them from Nixon through Clinton, Reagan, Nixon, all of them. And whatever they started out with, they weren't there at the end, because the process is that destructive of integrity and clarity and so forth. That's why you don't have adults watching the store. So for the longest time now, I've been willing to think that Barack Obama actually disproves my book. And I like having my book disproved, because my books are usually pretty gloomy, and I'd like to see some good news. And I actually was saying in speeches, Barack Obama's success means I was wrong, or maybe wrong, or maybe it's not as flawed. How could this guy emerge? Now I'm a little worried. And I think we need to help this fella, okay? And the reason I'm worried is that he's forgetting what got him to this place. And what got him to this place was being an adult watching the store, saying sensible things about our national security and about the threats we face and about negotiations and so forth. And what did he do in the last few weeks really scares me. And I think here we have this process that I described in my last book. And I witnessed it. I covered all these candidates. I ran around these campaign planes. I know the process. I know the advisors. They descend, they descend, they descend. They drive you crazy, and the media's all over you and everything else. And what did he do? He said, all right, you got Iraq, endless war. I'll see your Iraq, and I'll one-up you with an endless war in Afghanistan. That's really what happened, whether you want to hear it or not. Because the idea that we are going to send more troops into Afghanistan and straighten out Afghanistan. You could probably straighten out the rest of the world combined before you can straighten out Afghanistan. I mean, you're talking about a place that every empire has grounded to a halt on, But for one thing, it creates a great fallacy that we've indulged in since 9/11, that terrorism needs to be fought with a conventional war. There is no real evidence to believe al-Qaeda is even a significant force in Afghanistan anymore, that it even has strong ties to the Taliban. There was a relationship that existed before. As far as we can determine, they seem to be finding much more security in Pakistan. They seem to be finding more security in some of these Arab countries that are now buying up City National and Chase and General Electric and so forth. The people who supported the Taliban back then are the three countries that diplomatically recognized the Taliban were United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Pakistan. They all made out like bandits with U.S. policy after 9/11. But the Taliban-Al-Qaeda relationship, as far as I can see, and I certainly try to read everything I get my hands on, is a very tenuous one. And the Taliban is not primarily a movement concerned with the United States. This is, whatever else you think about the Taliban, an indigenous movement preoccupied with Afghanistan and parts of Pakistan, where the Pashtun are. And I don't know very many experts, or any experts really, who would deny that. We had a very good article on Truth Day by William Pfaff, who's probably one of the best foreign correspondents, writes for the Herald Tribune, and making just that point. But, I've heard this and read this from many people. So the idea that we're going to intrude in what is a civil war in Afghanistan is incredibly dangerous. But it also means that we Democrats have not learned the lessons from our own folly. Because where did this all come from? Afghanistan did not start out being a place of madness any more than Iran did. Okay? It did not start out being a place where people read the Quran a different way and suddenly became Islamo-fascist. One of the more vicious, stupid ideas that we've ever had, that's what it takes to be a terrorist. So how do you explain a Jewish terrorist killing Yitzhak Rabin? How do you explain Protestant and Catholic terrorists killing each other in Northern Ireland? I can go down the whole list. It's just nutsville. But the fact is, where did this come from? Okay, I'm going to give you the benefit of my great research, my vast army of secret agents, intelligence apparatus. I'm sitting in the garage last week, and my wife is yelling at me that if I don't go through my boxes, she's throwing them out. And I say, you mean my research? My decades of research? And she said, yeah, whatever you call it, it's going by 4 this afternoon. I've got somebody coming to get them. So I am frantically going through my treasures here. And the first thing I find of interest is an interview I did with Bob Dole in 1980. Bob Dole was running for president. And I interviewed him. It was front page of the Los Angeles Times. And my first question to Bob Dole, I said, what do you make of this Afghanistan thing? Remember, Carter wouldn't go to the Olympics. Remember, we have to fight Soviets there and everything, Afghanistan. And Bob Dole, in 1980, said, I think it's nonsense. I think it's made up. I think it's a distraction to take attention away from the hostage situation in Iran. You know, I don't see any evidence. The Soviets have always had influence there. What's the big deal? And where does this threaten us? And why are we getting involved? So forth. Bob Dole. But he still, even though he was a senator, even though he was briefed, thought the Soviets had gone in first. Right? And therefore it was a neighboring country. And they were supporting, even though it was a secular regime in Kabul, but the Soviets gone first. So I'm going through my boxes, and I find a press release from Simon & Schuster that had published a book by Robert Gates, who is now our Secretary of Defense, who used to be the head of the CIA, and back in the Carter years was the key guy on the National Security Council dealing with these things. So the book, in order to sell the book, they have these bullets telling you what great revelations there are. See, these people can reveal stuff to sell their books. Try to reveal it to inform the public, and you're a traitor. So he reveals there, one of the bullets, how the Carter administration backed the Mujahideen 6 months before the Soviets went into Afghanistan. Imagine that. 6 months before. All right? Now, couple that with an interview Zbigniew Brzezinski gave to Nouvelle Observatoire before 9/11, where he bragged about this. He said, what's the big deal in flaming some Muslim fanatics, which maybe we did, or bringing down the Soviet Empire? That was the way he presented it, inflaming some Muslim fanatics. So the whole problem of Afghanistan didn't start with a fairly reasonable king. It didn't start with the secular people challenging him. It started with our backing the most irrational element, the Mujahideen that were there, who were objecting to any modernization that would allow women and girls any freedom of any sort, okay? That was the deal. We backed them, all right? Just like we backed the coalition under Carter, we backed the coalition that was hiding out in Thailand on the other side of the border that included Pol Pot to get back in power in Phnom Penh because the Vietnamese had intervened and we were with the Chinese backing Pol Pot. Okay? And another bullet in this revelation in Gates's book was how we supplied intelligence to the Chinese in their war with the Vietnamese. Think about that. We went to Vietnam, 3.4 million people died, 59,000 Americans, ostensibly to stop international communism. All right? Ostensibly. Even though we make peace with the two big communist giants, we escalate this war. After the Vietnamese win and we lose, and this pertains to the current situation, in the most ignominious defeat this country has ever had, right? And McCain knows this, most ignominious defeat, what happens? They don't invade San Diego. The Vietnamese knock out Pol Pot, the most evil communist that ever lived, and they go to war with China over, you know, thousands of years of disputes about the border and islands and so forth. And we back the Chinese. We give the Chinese intelligence information on the Vietnamese. That's another bullet revelation. So when you look at the mischief that has occurred in our last 50 years, and it has been done equally by Democrats and Republicans, it's been done for crass political reasons, and I thought the change we needed was a post-Cold War change to recognize, and there are very strong signs of that with Barack Obama, that we live in a multipolar world, that we need the cooperation of people throughout the world, that diplomacy and understanding and trade have to replace militarism and empire building. We need that. And we, and you know, I say we because I know people will leave this building and say, oh yeah, but you know, Scheer's talking to the faithful and we're just a bunch of lefties. Yeah. Escondido, that's where I was this afternoon. I'm sorry if I'm a little dizzy. I do sometimes three of these a day. You know, so, but Escondido. And then I was in, where was I the other day? I was in El Segundo, which I had a lot of military defense workers come up to me after. Everywhere I go, they think they're not Americans. So they say, yes, we're concerned, but he can't win the election by paying attention to people like us. He's got to play the fool for those people out there. He's got to seem like the supreme idiot warrior. He's got to be jingoistic. He's got to be ultra-patriotic, you know? He's got to express family values that nobody in America believes in anymore. You know, whatever. You know, I mean, you've got all of that kind of so-called realistic talk, right? And I'm always amazed. I say, who made you guys non-Americans? You know, I mean, I was in South Florida, huge groups. One of my things I spoke in, they were mostly Cuban Americans. And they were very sensible and reasonable, not the way I hear Cuban Americans described ever, large crowd. And yet I got the same argument. We need Barack Obama to win, and the only way he's going to win is by pandering to this and doing this. I don't buy it. I think John Kerry lost the last election when he was asked, knowing what you know now, would you have invaded Iraq? And he said yes, and it was over. And Barack Obama, sure, you should care about the troops. Sure, you should care about our security. Sure, you should deal with all these foreign governments and know that you got your head screwed on right and everything else. That's all important. But for God's sake, why pretend that the Cold War is on when it's over? Why not acknowledge the world that we live in so we can deal with what George Bush the first said with the problems that we have? And we know these problems are real. They're big, and they require funding. So let me end on that, ask you to find your voice and challenge our candidate. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program by Global Voices for Justice. This has been a part of a series of presidential campaign period programs, this topic being the social impact of the U.S. military budget. This talk by Robert Scheer on the pornography of power was given in San Diego, California on July 26, 2008. This is Lisa Michelle Lovelace. Global Voices for Justice is a nonprofit media organization in Los Angeles, California. To contact us or obtain copies of this or other programs, please visit our website at globalvoicesforjustice.org or call us at 310-283-0885. That's 310-283-0885. Our music is by the Magic Bullet Theory, a local group in Long Beach, California. Thanks for listening.